Well, we're glad you're here tonight, and as you know, on Thursday night in our Bible study, it's any question you want to ask about the Bible. We want to welcome all our people coming in on YouTube and hope that you get a blessing at it. If you've got a question you want to ask, you just fire it into our YouTube guy, and he'll get it up to me. And, you know, we look forward to having a good time tonight in the Bible. Any question you want to ask, it's all good. And we'll get started. Who wants to get the first question going for us here?
Where at exactly does the Bible mention Lilith?
It's just, I'm sorry, honey?
Lilith. Where at in the Bible does it mention Lilith? Which was supposed to be Adam's first wife.
Eve, you mean?
No, Lilith.
Zilla.
Lilith.
Lilla.
Lilith.
Who?
Adam's,
you know,
Adam's first wife.
Because it ain't in the Bible. Lilith? Lilith. Oh, kind of like hairless. Lilith. Lilith. Got it. Lilith. Honey, I have no idea. There's no place in the Bible that Eve was the first woman created in Genesis chapter 2. And the Bible makes it very clear, goes into great detail, that Adam didn't have a wife, so God put him to sleep and brought the woman out of him, created it from him, and then gave her to him. So that is the only indication. Where did you hear about Lilith?
My grandmother is Irish, and she used to tell us stories when I was littler about Adam having a first wife, Lilith, who chose the path of Satan, so God banished her, and that's when he created Eve.
I get you. Well, first of all, that's... We all have stories that our parents and grandmothers tell us, you know, and that's okay. You know, it's my dad used to tell me stories all the time, and I found out they were true. that I was adopted, I was left on the doorstep, that I was stolen by a gypsy, back of gypsies when I was 9 years old. And but anyway, as far as the Bible's concerned and the truth of it, that's just a story that people make up, like a lot of other things. Another one is the fact that Eve, you hear it all the time, that Eve ate an apple in the garden, you know. That's a story that's handed down, and that's not true. That's not what it was. So, yeah, all due respect to your grandmother, you know, she was just telling you a story because she, like grandmas do. And but as far as the Bible's concerned, Eve was Adam's first wife, and that's very clear from the Bible. Everything else she's telling you sounds good, but there's no record of anybody collaborating it in history or the Bible. It's just a story. But no problem. That's a great question. It's good to start off with that one. Lilith.
So I am in Isaiah 27.
Okay. Yes.
And I'm in verse 1 in Isaiah 27. And it's talking about Leviathan and the dragon. And I know we talk about the great red dragon, but when you're reading in here, it's talking about slaying the dragon. And then, so in my notes, I've got the Leviathan is the devil. And then when it's talking about slaying the dragon, so what's coming to mind, slaying is killing from what I know. And then, so what I'm thinking is that to do with the Antichrist, if he's talking about slaying and the dragon portion of that?
Is it talking about what now?
The slay, it's, can we read it?
When it says he slays the dragon that's in the sea. Is that what you're asking about?
That's part of it, yes. So you know how we talk about the great red dragon? And then in this verse, it's talking about Leviathan, and it also talks about the dragon that's in the sea. Yeah, slaying him. So is that the Antichrist that he's slaying?
Well, what you have here in Isaiah 27, in fact, the whole chapter, really, but in those two verses that you're talking about, Leviathan obviously is the devil. There's no question about that. He defines that here, Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, the crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. You can go every place else in the Bible you need to go and get those defined coming back to being Satan. Now, if you look at verse 1 and 2, the context here, verse 2, is in that day. Context is the second coming of Christ. So when it's talking about the dragon being slain, it's talking about him being slain. Look at, in that day, the Lord with his sore and great strong sword. That's Revelation 19, verse 11, when a sharp two-edged sword comes out of a mouth by which he smites the nations. So the slaying here, the dragon, is actually the second coming of Christ. The sword is the word of God coming out of his mouth. The piercing serpent, Leviathan, the crooked serpent, the dragon, all of that is there. And then, of course, in that day, sing ye under her a vineyard of red wine. That's the Battle of Armageddon, Isaiah chapter 63, Revelation chapter 14, I believe it is, where it's the great bloodbath, and that's why he's saying the vineyard of red wine. It's called the wine press of Almighty God, where he stamps the people like somebody stamping grapes, and he stains his garment. And you see that in Revelation 19. Isaiah 63 is the key verse for it. Since we're in Isaiah, just come on back here and look at it. It says, 63:1, who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? Now, Edom and Bozrah, and I've given you this before, I've given you the route of the second coming of Christ, starting at Mount Sinai, coming up to the Mount of Olives in Zechariah chapter 14. Edom in Bozar, it starts out in the wilderness, it goes up through Sinai, it goes up through Seir, it goes up through Mount Paran, and then we've come into Edom and the Bozrah. And this is all places on the route of the second coming, coming up to the Battle of Armageddon. And he says here, who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength, I will speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Wherefore art thou red in thine apparel, in thy garments, like him that treadeth in the wine fat. So back here, we have a vineyard of red wine. Somebody's singing a song about the destruction of the Antichrist. I have treaden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me, for I will tread them in mine anger, trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment. Context, verse 4. For the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. And of course, second coming of Christ. So Isaiah 27, 1 and 2 is dealing about the slaying of the dragon at the second coming, than the vineyard of red wine being the Battle of Armageddon. Does that help you? Pardon me?
Yes. The slaying portion of it, is it slaying the Antichrist?
What's the slaying portion of it?
Yeah, it's slaying the Antichrist.
Are you just agreeing with me?
That's the slaying of the Antichrist in verse 1 and 2.
That's what I... Okay.
Yeah. Yes, next question. No more questions? Yes. Oh, Carlene.
Galatians 1:8.
Who?
Galatians 1:8.
Galatians 1:8. But though we, or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than that which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed.
Who are the other angel?
Her question is, who is this other angel here? Well, let's put it in a context here and see what he's saying, first of all. Just a minute. Just be glad I don't have a wooden leg. That'd take me a lot longer to put on. Now, her question here in verse 8 is, but though we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel unto you than which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. You got to put this verse in the context of what is happening here in the book of Galatians. What has happened here is that a group, a false gospel has arisen, verse 6. I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel. So in the church of Galatia here, what has happened, a group of people have brought in another gospel. And these people are called Judaizers. And they put... They're trying to put the New Testament Christians back under an Old Testament / New Testament gospel, that it's okay to believe in Christ, but he's here, but you still have to follow the law. And so this is what Paul is dealing with in the book of Galatians. If you don't have that note at the beginning of the book of Galatians, you want to put that in here. And what we have is a group of people coming into this church that are bringing in another gospel. So now you begin to see why Paul's response, what he says and how he's saying it. So let's read in verse 6, and then we'll come on up here. I marvel that ye are so soon removed from him that called you into the grace of Christ unto another gospel. And of course, from him that called you into the grace would be the Lord Jesus Christ himself. In other words, they got saved, they're part of the New Testament church. Which is not another, but there be some that trouble you and would pervert the gospel of Christ. These are the Judaizers. They're coming in and they're saying that, oh, it's not, salvation is not just justification by faith. Salvation is justification by faith and works, Old Testament, New Testament. Now, this has set up the book of Galatians, the theme of Galatians, because Paul gets into this book and he really deals with those issues that they're bringing in this false gospel. The book then forms for us one of the great books of the Bible, that its theme becomes our justification by faith. And Galatians and Romans go hand in hand together. And where Romans teaches that you're saved by faith through grace, Galatians teaches that once we're saved, we're kept by faith through grace. And this is what the Judaizers are trying to unhinge with the church here. So now that I've said that, verse 8 comes into crystal clarity. He's talking about that he's marveled that they've so soon dumped the gospel of Christ for another gospel, and then that there's people among them that are perverting the gospel. Now he's making a dogmatic doctrinal statement in verse 8. But though we or an angel from heaven, now there's no particular angel here, any angel at all. What he's saying here, he says he's not focusing on a particular angel, he's saying if we, or even an angel, just in a general sense, preach another gospel unto you other than which we have preached unto you, let him be accursed. So the angel here he's talking about is in a general sense of anybody perverting the gospel that they clearly have had delivered to them through Christ. And what he's saying is, let no man come down and let no man change your mind, and even if an angel from heaven would come down. And of course, you can't miss the swipe at the Mormon church with the angel Macaroni, or whatever his name was, who brought the golden tablets down to Joseph Smith. And they base their whole religion on this angel who gave Joseph Smith the golden tablets. So you know, can't miss the long-range, long-term swipe at that. But in the context here, he's talking in a general sense that if we would change it, or even an angel from heaven would come down, he's accursed, is what he's saying. Yeah. Good question. Yes, behind you.
Deuteronomy 14, 22 through 26.
Deuteronomy 14?
Yes.
Okay. What is it again, 24?
22 through 26. The question is really in 26, but it kind of gives you the context.
Okay. It says, verse 22, thou shalt truly tithe all the increase of thy seed that the field bringeth forth year by year. And thou shalt eat before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose to place his name there, the tithe of thy corn, of thy wine, and of thine oil, and of the firstlings of thy herds, and of the flocks thou mayest learn to fear the Lord thy God always. And if the way be too long for thee, so that thou art not able to carry it, or if thy place be too far from thee, which the Lord thy God shall choose to set his name there, when the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, then thou shalt turn it into money, and bind up the money in thine hand, and shall go unto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose. And thou shalt bestow that money on whatsoever thy soul lustest after, for oxen, or for sheep, or for wine, or for strong drink, or for whatsoever thy soul desireth. And thou shalt eat there before the Lord thy God, and thou shalt rejoice, thou and thy household.
Why would he tell them to buy strong drink?
Well, he's basically saying this. He's basically saying, if you're not going to do the tithe the way I tell you to do it, then you take it and you go do whatever you want to do with it. And if that means you want to go down to your friendly neighborhood tavern and drink it up, then you go ahead and do that. So he's not telling him to do that. He's just basically saying, if the way I've set down for you to bring your tithe is too far for you and you can't go there, then you just turn it into money and do whatever you want to do with it. That's what he's saying.
On the same question, would that be line up with the principle in the New Testament when God gives you over to a reprobate mind? Or is that something totally different? Would that be an example of a principle of that?
No, that's a total different. You're talking about in Romans over there. That's a totally different deal. I mean, here it's just somebody that, if you look back here, what God tells them to do, he says, and it's a great principle, thou shalt truly tithe all the increase of thy seed that the field bringeth before the Lord. And then he says, thou shalt eat there before the Lord thy God in a place which he shall choose, the tithe of thy corn. Now, he's telling them to give the tithe to the Lord, but then they go to the place that God chooses and then they eat it. The picture there from a practical application is that when we tithe, we don't eat it, but when they ate it, they gained strength, because it's real food. They gained strength from it. In other words, eating the tithe gave them strength. You and me tithing to God spiritually gives us the strength spiritually. What is the principle there, is what he's saying. And so then what you have down here is, if somebody doesn't want to do that, then he basically says, and we say it all the time, I've said it all my life, you know, God doesn't need your money. You know, and it's a thing where if you don't want to do it God's way and get the blessings of God, then go ahead and turn it into money, whatever you want, and buy your own blessings, is what he's saying. But that's not a reprobate mind. A reprobate mind is over there in Romans 1, which is dealing with the latter structure of sin going down to depravity of man, to the lowest part of it. We got one off the internet here?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
This is going over to Exodus 32.
Exodus 32. Okay. Okay.
So the question is pretty much just dealing with Aaron. Over here with the nation of Israel, he says pretty much, why is Aaron not killed when he makes this golden calf?
Why is he not killed?
Correct.
Why would he be killed? Is my question. Let me think what he's trying to ask here.
Him making a false idol god, I think that's what is coming from the premise of that.
Okay, well, if from the Bible standpoint, God had to have Aaron and Moses. I guess you could ask the same reason why God didn't kill David after Bathsheba. God saw something in David that he gave him the sure mercies of David that he didn't kill him when there was no other option, really. So here, I don't look at it as the exact same thing, but Aaron has to be the priest. Moses has to have that. So if he would have killed him, then the whole system would have broken down. So instead of killing him, he deals with him, and you know, Aaron, a great study in the Bible on strong leaders and strong leadership character. Aaron and Moses are two of the greatest studies on leadership. And Aaron is not a bad guy. Now, you find a lot of the people in the nation of Israel who are bad people, and they have a problem with God already. And they're always looking for an opportunity. Moses is a strong leader. Aaron is not a very strong leader. And within this story here on these principles of leadership, you see that Aaron is a very weak leader. And we already know that everything rises and falls on leadership. Being a leader is, when you read this thing out and you see Aaron can't stand up to the people. And when he's faced with it, he wants to blame it on the people. He's so weak he can't even take responsibility for what he did that was wrong. And so, you know, when Moses comes back and he's upset with him, then, you know, he basically can't take responsibility for what he's done. And he blames it on everybody else because that's what a weak leader does. And at the end of the chapter in verse 35, after Aaron alibied everything that he did and tried to put it off on everything everybody else's fault, verse 35 says, "And the Lord plagued the people because they made the calf which Aaron made." So God puts it right back squarely on his shoulders, and it's a problem of leadership, not a problem of sin in the sense of he's got a bad heart, that he was looking for every opportunity to disobey God like many of them were in the nation of Israel. He's a weak leader, and he succumbs to the people because he can't stand up to them. And there's a lot of people like that. And when you go back to chapter 32, you'll find that the definitive of two types of leaders is Moses. He's led by the book, and Aaron is led by popular opinion. And this gets him into trouble. It sets up for us some great principles on leadership that, you know, you want to look for in leaders. And, of course, the number one is that everything rises and falls on leadership. And, you know, the second great principle, is, and Aaron fails in, is being a leader is not about ability. Most people think that if a leader has great ability, that he's a great leader. Leadership is not about ability. Leadership is about taking responsibility. That's leadership. Because a leader, a good leader, is not responsible for the good decisions he makes, but he's also responsible for the bad ones he makes. And this is what Aaron couldn't do. A good leader has to be able to make the hard calls when they're not popular. Aaron couldn't do that. You see, Moses doing it all the time. He really doesn't give a flip what they think. Because him and God are face to face, and he knows God, and he's got the book down, where Aaron never had that ability. And Aaron is the of the two. He's vital to Moses, but he's the weak link. And, you know, and a good leader has to be able to make the hard calls. Everybody thinks that if you win all the time, that you're a great leader. And, of course, that's popular today because, you know, winning is everything to us. And leadership is not about winning. Leadership is about leading through adversity to get to the other side where you come out in the victory. And, of course, you know, people don't see that. Aaron couldn't do that. And, you know, a real leader, you know, you're never a real leader, and this is, of course, where Aaron failed. You're never a real leader until you face the adversity that and the criticism and all of the things that come along with being a leader, and then you lead through it. Now, these are the six things that Aaron could not do. So I can't read God's heart, God's mind, because obviously God had every right to kill him. But God saw something in him that he didn't kill him. And I don't have the insight into God's mind other than what I have in the chapter. And I know how vital he is to, as the priest, to what God is doing with the nation of Israel. I do know from looking at him and studying his life all through the Old Testament, Aaron, he's not a bad guy. He's not someone who's out to usurp Moses' authority. He's not somebody out there to try to, circumvent and destroy the nation of Israel. He really has God's agenda at heart. He's just a weak leader. And his failure here is not one of sin, even though it led the people to sin. His failure here is one of leadership. And in that would be my reasoning or my answer to you why God didn't kill him when he should have killed him. God didn't kill David because he was the greatest leader that Israel ever had. And God needed him in the line of Christ. If he would have killed him, which he had a right to do, it would have messed up the whole system. So God saw something in David that he didn't see in anybody else, and he spared David's life, even though by the letter of the law, David should have died, because he saw in him something that he didn't see in anybody else. So he gave him that sure mercies of David and spared his life because of the fact that he saw something in David's heart that he didn't see in, like, Saul's heart or Absalom's heart. It's the same principle here, just not on the same level. Biblical leadership is based on biblical principles, good or bad, and you having to follow them. And Aaron's problem is he's just not a strong leader, and he followed popular opinion, and he led the nation of Israel into a mess. But I guarantee you, it was the people who were already at odds with God who wanted to go back to Egypt that were pushing Aaron's buttons. Aaron just wasn't strong enough to withstand them. So in that, I would say, is the reason why God didn't kill him when he could have killed him, or maybe he should have killed him, because it shows us the two types of leaders, Moses and Aaron, and shows us the strong points of Moses and then the weak points of Aaron. And you could take that through right into the time that we live today. Most churches have problems that get out of control and run rampant that causes all kinds of issues because that the man at the top is not a strong leader. And they don't deal with issues. You can see it in a family. Kids run wild and get all messed up and do all things in the world because the dad's not a strong leader. Leadership is the key. And, you know, it's a thing where there have been many, many families, Christian families that I've seen over my years where the people were good people, but they lost their kids. And they lost their kids not because mom and dad were drunkards or dope addicts. They lost their kids on one fundamental principle that dad was not a strong leader. And that'll ruin your family. So you see there's a difference as God looks at it, and I certainly don't speak for God here, but as God looks at it, God looks into the heart of man. And he sees one man who fails because he's weak. He sees another man who fails because he's wicked. And God will not deal with the two the same way. So it's a system here, in this case, I would say, based on the information that we have, that God was looking inside of Aaron and saw something there that he didn't see in the other people who were right ready to go back to Egypt and wanted to stone Moses and defy God, and they were right ready. But even at that, God holds his feet to the fire and God holds him responsible. In verse 35 is a great verse because it shows no matter what alibis we make as leaders, at the end of the day, verse 35, my note, everything rises and falls on leadership. It was his. He owned it. But
hey,
that
Dad,
would be my take on it.
What were those six things that Aaron failed to do?
I just gave them to you. But I will give them to you again just because it's you. Now, number one is my preface for the other things that we're going to talk about here. Number one was that everything will rise and fall on leadership. And you see that in this story, chapter 32, of Moses and Aaron. Moses, as I said, he leads by the book. He's led by God. He does everything by the letter that God tells him to do. Aaron, on the other hand, in the chapter, is led by popular opinion. He caves in to people. And so the first aspect is that everything rises and falls on leadership. Success or failure, you know, will be all about the person that leads you. John F. Kennedy said one time after the Bay of Pigs disaster, he said, success has many fathers, but failure is always an orphan. And that is so true. But at the end of the day, he understood a great truth, and he took responsibility for it, that he was the president of the United States, and it was on his watch, and everything rises and falls on leadership. The second thing here that Aaron failed to understand is that being a leader is not about ability. Aaron may have had the ability to be a leader, but where Aaron failed, that leadership is not about ability, but is about responsibility. He failed to take responsibility for the people of God, left in his trust by the man who was running everything by the book. So he failed in that. And then the third thing here that he fails in is that Aaron as a leader is not just responsible for the good decisions he makes, but also for the hard ones or the bad ones that have to be dealt with. He's not willing to do that. He made a bad choice. Once he, you ain't going to tell me for a heartbeat, the moment he gave in to that thing, that inside he knew he didn't, he was wrong. The problem is he didn't have the courage to reverse his bad decision. That's bad leadership. We all make bad choices. We all make bad decisions. A real good leader will recognize it when it's pointed out to him, when he sees that it is true, and he'll reverse it. He won't trump it up in pride and say, well, I'm the leader, so don't you tell me I'm wrong. No, you are the leader, and you are wrong just like everybody else, so man up and take responsibility for it. The fourth thing, and this is what he's not able to do. A good leader has to be able to make hard calls. When these people came to him, he should have shut it down right there. There's always going to be an opportunity for any Christian that is a leader to maintain his, and I tell people all the time, in any situation in life, no matter what it may be, whether you're in a counseling scenario or you're a pastor or you're discipling somebody or you're working with somebody or whatever, rule number one is you never lose control. And, you know, and that is based on the person who's doing what God wants him to do, God always is going to give him the upper hand in it. And God's always going to take care of the person who does what's right. It's just that simple. Most people can't see that. And so, therefore, they get themselves into a situation and they don't see the situation as, even though it is a bad situation, you have the upper hand. Take, for instance, in a marriage situation, and you got a husband who's not doing what's right. The woman does not know this many times, but no matter how bad your situation is, if you are doing what's right and you want to live for God, and you got a bozo husband who does not, you have the upper hand. You have all the cards stacked against him in the deck that you're holding. You just got to know how to play those cards. Most of them don't, so therefore they get overcome and they lose control and they become victims. There's never a chance, or should be a chance, that when you're doing what's right with God that you ever become the victim. Simply because God is on your side and you have the principles of the Word of God that are going to dictate how you handle a situation where the other person is not doing what's right, does not have those principles. But you have to be able to make the hard call. And sometimes, even in any situation, certainly pastoring, certainly in marriages, certainly in dealing with people, there are times that you have to put friendship aside and you got to make the hard line call. And you're going to get clobbered because they're going to depend on your friendship not to call them on the carpet. And a leader puts friendship aside, and a leader leads. And he has to be able to make the hard calls. Aaron couldn't do that. When those people came to him and they said, hey, Moses is not here anymore. He's gone, man. We don't even know if he's alive. He may be dead. Somebody probably got him up there. Bigfoot got him. The abominable snowman got him. He's not coming back. What are we going to do now? He should have stopped it right there. But he's weak. And when all the people wanted to go nuts and do all these things, he should have shut it down as the leader. He had full responsibility. He had full authority. He's second in command, but he's weak. He had everything as a leader. He had everything going for him that he could have controlled the situation and never lost control. But he lost it because he couldn't make the hard call. The next thing he does is leadership is not about winning, as I said, but it's about leading through adversity. The real mark of a leader is leading. You're gonna find, if you ever pastor a church someday, that you're gonna have problems in any church, and most people never see the problems the way they really need to be seen. In any church, you're gonna have people who are going to cause problems. You just see it. You don't see it so much here simply because of the fact that things are so tightened up with the principles in the Bible and so many people are in the book that, the the problem germs don't have a chance to cultivate in the culture. They get killed by all the antibodies. They used to call them Anabaptists, but they call them antibodies now. But it's a thing where, any church is going to have it. And many churches get destroyed because of it. And everybody takes sides. Everybody, gets their side of the story, gets this or gets that. But leadership in a pastor, his job is to, no matter what the situation is, his job is to lead through that adversity. And there's a way that you do that. There's a process that you lead through adversity, because you got people out there. Every time you have a problem in a church that becomes a problem, you're going to have collateral damage. You got young Christians out there. You got people that get caught up in it that don't know anything, and you always got the brothers and the sisters that want to make sure they know all their side of the story. So you got to control that. And the way you control that is not by pulling people aside and doing this or doing that, or by churching everybody, though that sometimes has to be done. But the way that you combat that is by strong leadership. Hey, it's your pulpit. What you say from the pulpit, nobody else gets to say. I mean, you got people yipper-yapping out here, but on Sunday morning or Thursday night or whenever you call a meeting, you got the pulpit. And you lead from that pulpit. You lead through the adversity. You don't kill anybody that you don't have to. You just state the facts. You deal with the facts. And you lead through adversity, and that's what a leader has to do. It's not about winning. It's not about, well, we showed them. It's not about we showing anybody. It's about in any situation where you have God's people, you're going to have issues. And those issues need strong leadership for somebody to lead through the adversity. If you don't, then you're going to have some real problems. I say this, most pastors today, and I've been in this business a long time, most pastors today are not very good leaders. That's why they have so many issues. That's why they have so many problems in their churches. That's why they have so many issues. They can't take they're so afraid about somebody getting mad and leaving their church that they'll never make the hard call or take the stand, because they're afraid they're going to leave. They've never learned that the fact that having those kind of people stay long-term are going to cause you tenfold problems if you just let them leave when they needed to leave. But see, that's something you learn, and that takes somebody saying, you know what, above everything, I love you, I'll do what I can do for you, I'm here for you, but at the end of the day, let God be true and every man a liar. The book has to be what it's built on, or it isn't built on anything. So leadership is not about winning. It's about leading through adversity. And then, of course, you're never going to be a real leader till you face adversity, till you face criticism, and you face failure, and you lead through it. Yeah, leaders don't quit. Leaders don't give up. Leaders always find a way. Leaders know that everybody's depending on them to lead. People are looking to them to lead. And, the real test of any leadership, whoever it may be, will be the test of the adversity that you face and how you lead through it. And it'll be the adversity of problems. It'll be failures, bad choices. How you lead through that and you get to the other side is what leadership's all about. These are the things that Aaron couldn't do. He couldn't lead through adversity. He was more worried about what the people thought than he was worried about what God thought. And like I said, Moses, this is a great chapter on leadership. You know, Moses is a guy who runs by the book. He leads by God's favor, face to face. Aaron's, he leads by popular opinion. And, it's biblical leadership in this case here. It's true of today. It's true of any time in history. Biblical leadership is based on principles, good or bad. You got to deal with it. And, you know, you got to leave the emotions out of it. You got to just deal with the principles as you find the truth. And then everybody either wraps themselves around it or gets as far away from it as they can. But that's how it works. So that is my assessment on it, why God didn't kill him. He needed him. He saw something in him that he didn't see in the other ones that he did kill. And I look at it a lot like David. And, you know, Aaron's not a bad guy. He's just a weak leader. Yes, ma'am.
So in verse 5.
32:5?
Yeah. So this is after Aaron makes the calf and he says, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. So is that Aaron trying to make this right? Or
I'm sorry?
Does he think he's doing the right thing? Or?
Well, he could not have thought he was doing the right thing. But when you feel peer pressure from all the people, and we're talking about thousands of people here all wanting to do this, and you're a weak leader, you're going to talk yourself into it. Well, this is really what God wants me to do. Yeah, that's all. It's called rationalization. You get yourself in a jam, and you know that this is not how Moses would have done it, but here I am. I got 6,000 people screaming at me. Suddenly, I got an answer from God. Tomorrow's going to be a feast day. God says, and we'll just see how that works out for you. Yeah, he's feeling the peer pressure of everybody around him. He's just weak. I mean, if you get out in the world and you see it, you see it everywhere. We talk about it in pastors, and I've seen it that way, but you see it in everything. You see it in the corporate world. You see people who are just, you know, they're putting in charge of being a supervisor or this or that, and they no more should be in charge of a supervisor than a dead canary. They just can't. They can't do anything, you know. They're just always worried about what somebody else thinks. And a leader has to be cautious of people's concerns, but he can't make his decisions based on that. He has to encompass them. He has to understand them. He has to embrace them. But at the end of the day, you got to follow the book. It's that simple. Go ahead.
Do we ever see in the Bible Aaron, like, example or a story of him being a good leader, or is he mainly just used kind of as a contrast?
He's always in Moses' shadow. Okay. And that's why God picked him. When you go back to how he gave Moses Aaron, you know, he gave Moses Aaron because of the fact that Moses couldn't speak well. He had problems speaking, and he was afraid to go before Pharaoh. You know, he gives him Aaron, who is the priest, and Aaron can speak eloquently. And so he takes Aaron with him before Pharaoh. Aaron does the talking, but Moses bears the brunt of it because Moses is the focal point as the leader. So Aaron's always got a covering. This is the only time that he's really left out on a limb to be the leader, and he's not very good at it. He needs to stick with translating. But that's a great chapter. My favorite chapter on leadership. Looking for leaders. What does it take? You know, this used to drive me crazy. It doesn't happen here. Years when I used to train people to work with people, and this is just to infuriate me. They'd bring a problem to me, and they'd be working with somebody. And they'd bring a problem to me, and I'd say, we can't do that. Here's what you need to do. You need to go and tell this person, this is how you're going to handle this. This person, you need to tell this person, this is what they need to do. And sometimes it wasn't a pleasant thing. I mean, we were not talking about, you know, they need to pay their light bill. It was deeper than that. And these suckers, they'd go and they'd say, well, I talked to Bob, and Bob told me that this is what you got to do. See, that's not leadership. Now, when I found people that did that, I took them right out of leadership. They didn't work with anybody. I wouldn't even let them train dogs. I wouldn't even let them take mine out the potty. Let me tell you something. If you're a leader and we're working in this ministry together, and there's a hard call to make, why don't you pass that buck to me? You just simply go back and say, you know what, I talked to Bob about it, and I decided this is what I'm going to do, based on the Bible. Don't pull the Aaron approach. Don't hide behind it and say, well, you know, I've even had him say this. Well, you know, I talked to Bob about it. You know how he is. You know, this is what we're going to have to do. I kill you, you sucker. You be the man. You get out there and you say, look, this is the way it is. I cleared it with Bob. We went and looked at it. I'd even throw in this. He told me to handle it one of two ways. This is how I'm going to handle it. Take the bite, man. Well, he won't be my friend anymore. Well, if that's the kind of friend he had in the first place, he wasn't much. Bible says a friend loves at all times. Yes, ma'am. Oh, we didn't answer his question. I interrupted him.
Oh,
go
sorry.
Ahead.
Is it the same topic?
Yes. Is yours? Okay. So, what's that? What? Okay. So the same question. So what's the difference between kind of hiding behind it, but knowing your limitations and coming to you?
Say what now?
What's the difference between kind of hiding behind, like not being a good leader and really kind of just laying it out like you need to lay it out, and knowing your limitations
in
a situation?
I have a really good answer for you.
Oh, boy.
Uh-oh. Her question is, how does a leader, when they're faced with a hard decision, how do they know the difference between them crawfishing and not dealing with the problem right? You know what crawfishing is, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. not dealing with the issue like Aaron would, or somebody who knows their limitations and you know, and backs off a little bit, what you're saying, right? That's a great question. And the answer to that is that a leader would understand that this is what I need to do, and this is what I should do, and this is what I really want to do, but I'm not going to do that because I think if I do that, then I'm going to lose something over here. So I'm going to work this another angle to get the same results done, but if that doesn't work, then I will drop the hammer. The one is just blatantly not doing it. The other one is knows what should be done, knows what could be done, but then injects grace into it to say, you know what, I'm just going to wait and back off one couple of notches here to try to deal with this way and try to bring it around another way, but fully knowing that what the end result is going to be if it doesn't work. That's the difference. Yeah, you have to do that all the time. You know, you get situations where you know, especially with people who have had what I call repeat offenders. They screw up every month over on the same stuff, just over and over and over and over again. And then you get so sick and tired of it, you just want to clobber them. And you go into the meeting thinking you're going to clobber him, thinking about all day how you're going to clobber him, sleeping at night enjoying how you clobbered him. And then you get into it, and then the Lord says, now, you know what, okay, you're the man, you're the leader, yeah, you're the man, now let's just do this way. And you do it the right way, and you walk out, and you say, Lord, you were right. And he says, right about what? I am the man, Lord, I am the man. Go ahead, back here.
Hi, Bob. Yeah. Back in Genesis 6-7.
Genesis who?
6-7.
6-6?
6-7.
6-7, okay. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing, and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them.
Now, obviously, God didn't destroy every man or every creeping thing because of Noah and the ark and all the animals that God put in the ark.
And how would you know that?
Because you keep reading.
Yeah, verse 8. Yeah,
right. And then, but my question here is, that's a good one, man.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
The question is, it says that in verse 6, prior verse before that, can you read that one?
Yeah, you read any one you want. Read Leviticus 16:3 if you want.
Okay.
It's got nothing to do with this, but if you want to read it, go ahead.
Okay.
And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart.
Okay, so the thing is God's going to destroy man. And these beasts and creeping things from the face of the earth and the fowls of the air. But he doesn't mention anything about the fish of the sea, obviously, probably because of water and all that. But my thing is, back in Genesis 1:26, man had dominion, and the first thing it says is over the fish of the sea, and then the rest of the creatures. And I didn't know, is it just because of the water that God had those fish in the sea? And obviously, it was because of water he destroyed the earth, and it had the fish in the sea, they still lived.
Well, I'm sure that obviously many of the fish that were in the sea probably did die just because of the disaster that was befalling the earth. But it doesn't say that because obviously many of the species in the sea survived the flood and went on. And this is why when you get down in deep into the, 10, 12 miles into the ocean, you see the creatures that are on the bottom that we don't even know what kind of species they are. Every once in a while, something dead will wash up on the beach that nobody's ever seen it before, and it's, what we would classify as a sea monster. We know more about the moon and the solar system than we knew about our own oceans. And there were many things. We know that the dinosaurs did not go through the flood. We know that. But I would think it would be safe to say that a lot of the prehistoric animals that that were there in the ocean probably survived to some degree. Now, why God did that, he doesn't say. Why he spared them and doesn't say that here, it doesn't say that either. God's main dominion is going to be the man that he created and the things on the earth. It may be, and this is just speculation based on what we do know to be true, it may be that God didn't kill everything in the sea simply because in the Bible, all life comes from water. And that was significant that he didn't do it. I don't know that for sure, but I do know that water is the key element for life. So you don't get a good answer on that other than the fact that obviously he didn't, and obviously some species survived through it. Not all of them did. But, you've heard stories, all your life about strange things they've seen in the sea and all those things, and a lot of those are probably true. I know a lot of it's probably drunken sailors, but, there's things there that came out of Genesis 6 that that probably came through the flood and are probably down there. Outer space has nothing on inner space or the seas. And the reason why God obviously put it under such great depth is because of in Genesis 6, before the flood, these civilizations were rampant. There wasn't any Atlantic or Pacific oceans back in Genesis 6. There were seas. But the great oceans as we know them today didn't come into being until after the flood. So, you don't have a real good answer on it, but you can sift through the information that you do have, and that's basically what you have. So there is still hope for the Loch Ness Monster. Next question. John Gowan's down here.
Numbers 23:22.
God brought them out of Egypt and hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn.
So what exactly is a unicorn? It's mentioned 6 times in the Bible.
Are they 6 different unicorns or are they the same ones?
I don't know.
Well, till you find out, don't ask that question. Well, a unicorn, again, I've never seen one. A unicorn is, isn't that the horse with the spike on it? Huh? Yeah, okay. Obviously, you have 3 animals in the Bible that are mentioned, and they're not mentioned because they didn't exist. You have satyrs, centaurs, and unicorns. And so those 3 are mentioned in the Bible. Now, they're all connected with Satan when you find them. So obviously we don't have any satyr. A satyr is a half man, half horse. A centaur is half man, half goat. And then, of course, a unicorn is a horse with a unicorn. So, I would say, based on what their connection is with the Bible, first of all, the Bible just doesn't make up animals, for mythology purposes. If the Bible says satyrs and centaurs, then you can be well assured that they were someplace in history. If it mentions a unicorn here, we know that they had to be in Genesis chapter 6 because when Noah made the ark, there was green alligators and long nest geese, Humpty Dump camels and a big horse geese. But who didn't get on?
The silly unicorn.
The unicorn didn't get on. Why?
He was silly.
Playing silly games.
That's right.
Yes, right. Which proves that there were Baptists back in Genesis chapter 6. You never heard that song? You never heard that song. How many has heard that song? Oh, my goodness.
Sing a verse for us.
That is an old song. All about the story about the unicorns not getting on the ark.
What's they were the name of
silly
it?
Game. Anyway. Okay. So, we know in Genesis chapter 6, that there were animals back there that were different than animals today. And, you know that that's where the dinosaurs were found. There were animals back there that their kinfolk are here today, but like the saber-toothed tiger, the elephant, and you had the woolly mammoth back then and all that stuff. So we see renditions of things coming through, but for whatever reason, God didn't allow everything to come through. Now, obviously, there were horses back then, and obviously, that's where the unicorns fit in. And just to think that the fact that, there wasn't horses with horns back there, we have rhinoceroses with horns. I mean, we have elephants with tusks. I mean, it's no strange thing that a horse back there could have had horn on it. And for whatever reason, God didn't have them come through the flood. But, you know, so now hundreds and hundreds of years later, a guy could write a song about it and make a lot of money. But anyway. Now, the centaurs and the satyrs are something else. We are told that when the sons of God came down, that they cohabited with the daughters of men. That's angels mixing their seed sexually with human women and producing a race of giants. But then over in Jude, it also says that they went after strange flesh. Now, the strange flesh is not human. It's not. Strange flesh would be them going after and having sexual relations with the animals. And it produced the half man, half goat, half man, half horse. The angelic seed into the animals would mess up the strain of genes unbelievably, and to the point where it actually produced a half man, half goat, or a half man, half horse. And so those objects, those items are mentioned in the Bible. That means, if you're a Bible believer, that means that they were somewhere within the Bible scope. Once you put it together that the sons of God came down and were mixing angelic seed with human seed, and then you also see they were mixing it with animal seed and producing what they produced. The reason why I know that is true is because the idea of sexual relations with animals has been a part of Baal worship in the nation of Israel down through the Old Testament. Under the law, it was a violation punishable by death for a woman or a man to lie with a beast because it was going on all the time. Called bestiality. So it was happening all the time. The difference was it was human beings now. Back then it was the sons of God. Their seed was much more potent to produce something more than just human seed was. And, you know, we see it up through, even in the modern times, up through the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, you know, syphilis was a disease that there was no cure for. If you got it, you died from it. And there wasn't any cure for it till about 1930 someplace in there when they found penicillin. And, you know, syphilis was not a disease that came about from human beings. Syphilis was a disease that came into being from the Roman Empire of the Romans in their drunken orgies having sexual relations with animals, sheep in particular. Now, we have today a modern rendition of that in the AIDS virus. And the AIDS virus goes back to Africa and sex with monkeys, and these things cross the board. Genesis, Romans chapter 1, they jump the strain, and then a disease forms that the human body has no way to battle. And we were lucky with syphilis; we're not so lucky with AIDS. And it's a thing where this is what happens. So I would put those satyrs and centaurs and the unicorns back in Genesis chapter 6 before the flood. God wipes them out with the flood. And, you know, and then we go on from there. So that's probably what you're dealing with.
So I was just wondering if they were really like what...
They're real. They were real, yeah.
Right, because... Don't mock me for this, but if you read a commentary, they'll say it was like an ox or a...
Yeah. Well, why would I mock you for that?
That would suggest I read a commentary.
I read them all the time. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Yeah, it's a thing. It's fine. You know, yeah, but they do that because they have no understanding of the Bible. They don't know what to do with
right.
it. So... The standard rule with educated people, when you come up against something in the Bible, you know what to do. God has to be wrong, and I have to be right, so let's change it and make it something or make it go away. So you find the same thing in Job chapter 40, 41, two greatest chapters in the Bible on the devil, and they got him likened to an elephant, a whirlpool.
Right.
Yeah.
Leviathan, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And, of course, he says he will speak soft words to you. You ever flush your toilet and hear that little voice down there? Just flush your goldfish down the toilet.
quick question. Would those centaurs and, like, satyrs have, like, souls, or would they be, like, considered, like, those maybe things that are found over there in Peter that are, like, you know, in prison, those spirits that are found in prison?
Well, that's where they probably wound up, yes. That's probably where they wound up. That would be part of that crowd, yeah. You're right.
How come most of the time the unicorn is used in a positive context?
Well, because I didn't put unicorns in the same league with satyrs and centaurs. They probably were. I mean, what's wrong with a horny horse? I didn't mean that. Okay, folks, thanks. Come back tomorrow night. We'll try to put this thing back together. What I was trying to say. Boy, there'll be a lot of people watching this tomorrow. Things will be going up there, 200, 300, 943. What I meant was, what's wrong with a horse with a horn? Oh, boy. Yeah, I hope so. Anyway, try to bring this big back to into the scrapyard. So I didn't put it in the same category with those because they're probably okay. I mean, I'm sure there was a lot of animals that didn't get through the ark that there was no satanic connection with. I mean, brontosauruses, you know, all the plant-eating dinosaurs, they're just big reptiles. I mean, I know that the Antichrist is likened to behemoth, but a behemoth is a, you know, that's not really a dinosaur. I know we use it for that. It's more of a composite of a beast, which the Antichrist is. So you find that, you know, even the dinosaurs, some of the more basic ones, there wasn't any connection with that. They were just put on this earth, but God chose for them not to come through. I think that, you know, the unicorns were probably, you know, nothing wrong with them. But for whatever reason, God chose them not to come through. And I wouldn't understand the reason for that. But that's why I did not put them in the same category with the centaurs and the satyrs. I wish they would have. Do you ever have one of those times when you just... Your pulpit is never big enough to hide behind. Yeah, well, I meant to say, you know what I meant to say. I don't know how I said it. Got this terrible, I got this terrible head cold. I'm not thinking clearly. I am mucinexed up to my eyebrows, and the cough syrup I take makes me hallucinate. In fact, I saw 4 or 5 unicorns running through the back there just a few minutes ago. Okay, now you know I'm human just like everybody else. Go ahead.
Yeah. In Isaiah 34, it mentions the unicorns again, but this time they're actually, Isaiah 34:7, it actually records an action of the unicorns. They shall come down with them, and it looks like God just wipes them all out.
Isaiah 34?
Yeah, 7.
Hang on a minute, I get there.
And Bob, by the way, this is like the last time the unicorn is mentioned in the Bible.
Okay, I'll mark that.
Yeah. Some nugget of wisdom there.
I will. I don't have that in there. I will mark that. Last time unicorns in the Bible. I'll do it before I go to bed tonight. Okay, what is your question here, Sean?
Yeah, in Isaiah 34:7, it looks like it records that unicorn's action. They shall come down with them. And it looks like in verse 8, the Lord just basically wipes them all out because of his vengeance. So we know that they don't exist now, and it's recorded in between Genesis. Before Genesis 6, they were real, as you stated. After that, David mentions them as the strength of the unicorns in positive context. But here it looks like they come back, and you just mentioned about the sons of God mingling with the seeds of men again. And it just appears here that they actually come back. And is that right or no? Yes or no, Bob? Quick.
Stay tuned for next week. We'll come back with that one.
Oh, hang on here. Okay, now, you know, John over here talked about his commentaries. It says in verse 6, unicorn, verse 7, unicorn, and I got a little number 2 by it. Now, this is in your Oxford Wide Margin Bibles, you see. They're going to help you. So I come over here to my 2, and it says rhinoceros. See? That's the way they work it. They just cannot believe that there were unicorns. There has to be something else. And so they think, what else had a horn? Well, Volkswagen. Somebody didn't make it a Volkswagen. So we make it a rhinoceros, because a rhinoceros has got a horn. That's what they do. Now, obviously, the passage here, Sean, you're right, is the second coming of Christ down here, the vengeance for the day of the Lord's vengeance. I don't profess to know how the unicorns fit into that, what they're representing here, but obviously they're there. You're right. You say that is the last time it's found in the Bible? Okay, that makes sense.
Hey, I actually have something to go with that. You're familiar with CERN and all that paranormal activity with CERN over there in Europe, where they're trying to figure out the God particle and how to see how it all works. They're trying to claim that's the Big Bang and how to, you know, structurally how it comes from with CERN. You looked into CERN, right? Anyway, they're smashing particles together. Yeah, they're trying to make a bigger particle accelerator in China, and it's going to end up in the ocean. But anyway, the thing is does that, since it has paranormal activities that they're claiming that everybody that's around that vicinity, like, are, you know, going delirious and seeing dreams of demons and stuff like that. The thing is, if they're trying to figure out something, and some say could create a portal or a black hole or any kind of theory off the wall like that, just because they're playing with this so-called God particle, is that something that you can bring to the table in a beaker with a man's seed and something in a paranormal activity right there? I mean, could it be explained? Because it's a big thing right now. It is. It's a big thing on YouTube, and you got to cast all that stuff down. I just want to know.
Let me clarify something. China is a black hole. Okay.
You want him to say that again? I think I got some.
Let me ask you if I got this straight. Over in China, they're trying to make big particles. This has to do with atoms and neutrons and radiation. Am I right?
CERN. CERN.
What?
CERNer.
No, not CERNer.
What?
CERN.
What's a CERN? Oh, okay. What is...
The Hadron Collider,
yes. Explain to me what a CERN is.
So basically, that's the company that created the Hadron Collider, and it's rumored that they're... Well, what? It's not rumor, but they're scientists watching particles collide at super speeds, and they're seeing it explode.
I've seen that on I-70.
Right. And the thing is, they're trying to figure out the Big Bang, and they kind of discovered they call it the God particle.
Oh, yes, I do know about the God particle.
Okay, now what they're claiming for the past, like, 7, 8 years, that people are having delirious paranormal activities with their brains around the areas of study. And there's other preachers that are preaching that this is how Satan is going to usher his minions out of the earth. Now, the thing is, a man's playing around with this crap. Now, is it something that we can take any validity to where, you know, demons could come from? Or, I mean, just your opinion. That's all I'm asking. I'm not.
Yeah, okay. Certainly.
Can I go first?
Unicorns had horns on their nose. The first thing I want to get across. Here's my take on it. First of all, there is nothing that man is going to do that's going to open up a black hole. Okay? That's not going to happen. So I look at this as a new age seance. Where in the old days you had a seance where you got around and tried to call Aunt Edna back and Uncle Fred. these guys are doing it around the nuclear side of things, on the science side of things, but the end result is the same. It becomes demonic activity. And just as a fortune teller or a woman who is a necromancer or dreams or answers, whatever, a soothsayer in the Bible, she'll have her demon contact like the witch at Endor. She actually had demon contacts that worked with her, that when somebody came in and wanted to do whatever sure to do, they would enact that and, one, give credibility to her, two, discredit the Bible and God because she's got contact. This is why when Saul goes down there, he wants to call up Samuel. Well, she couldn't call up Samuel on her best day. She would call up her demon contacts who would imitate Samuel. But God intervenes. And when God intervenes, Saul looks in and he sees God's ascending out of the earth. There's her demon contacts that she's been working with. And then God allows Samuel, he interrupts the whole process and brings Samuel up for the purpose of saying to Saul, your days are done, pal, you're going to die. But my point is this, she had a medium by which she used unclean spirits to put forth the idea that she could actually contact the dead. These guys are doing the same thing on a New Age level, and the demonic activity around it is giving them the credibility that they're able to do this just like it was back then or like it is down 35th and Truce, down that little lady down there that has a little shop up. It's a thing where that's how they work, and this is what's happening. I don't know all the ramifications of it. I don't really seriously think the Antichrist is going to come in through that way or whatever, because I don't think it's anything legit. I think it's one more time on a very sophisticated level where the unsaved world is going to come into a demonic contact based on a scientific concept that is going to open up the secrets of the universe, which is going to be nothing more than a $49.99 seance versus a $10 one. It just got all the bells and whistles, but there's nothing there. Nothing is going to happen, but the demonic activity is what pulls it all together and makes it look like it's really something incredibly, something everybody want to look into. And the stupid preachers and pastors, they fall for that stuff, you know. First of all, you got to understand, they got nothing to preach Sunday, so they're looking for whatever they can get. And so they grab something like this and, you know, wow, they can get 2 or 3 weeks out of this. Like, remember back when the blood moon was out, all the pastors were saying, well, I'm going to preach this Sunday about the blood moon. Everybody's going, ooh, the blood moon. Yeah, dirt in the atmosphere. Exciting. But that's just what you got. So, well, we'll hold up there. It's been an auspicious night.